You know what? We were doing it just as good and in some cases better.
One thing that we sort of, I guess, spun off or derived from Americans over Sesame Street. I mean, we talk here about how, obviously, Sesame Street started in, like, 68 or 69, and then Sesame Street Canada started in 1972.
Sunny day, sleeping out, clouds away.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, Sesame Street, when it showed up in 69, it was like when the Beatles showed up. It just changed everything. The editing, the musical numbers, the animation, the puppetry. It was just like on all fronts. It was the most incredible shakeup, really, of the children's genre. And, of course, it was popular in Canada. It was being shown on CBC. But there was a lot of concern because of the segments that were in Spanish. And they said, well, this is no use to Canadian children, right? And it's like, I don't know, 7 or 8 minutes of every episode was dedicated to that.
We're waiting for a friend of ours.
Yeah, you gotta guess.
Look at all these clues.
Let's see, now the sign says, bienvenido, and that means welcome in Spanish. Whoever you're waiting for speaks Spanish, and I speak Spanish, therefore I can...
So whoever it was within the CBC said, well, why don't we start to create our own segments that are in French.
La lettre D. Danger. Danger. Dynamite. Dynamite. Dinosaur. Dinosaur.
And they worked with the Sesame Workshop and they started to create this Canadian version. Then over time, they started to do more and they started to make puppets. And it was Clive Vandenberg who was tasked with doing that. He ended up making Today's Special and Cucumber and other programs. And they eventually called it Sesame Park. And the thinking was that in America, kids all play on the street, but in Canada, kids play in a park. So that was why they called it that.
I mean, that was one of those things that I remember read that. I was like, that sounds so perfect that I want to double check that. Where was the source on that? Where did that come? I guess
the title.
Yeah,
Clive Vandenberg, the man himself. Yeah, he's still around, and I mean, again, he's I consider him an auteur of television. All of the stuff that he did has the same kind of qualities. There's a lot of emphasis on music. Again, the brilliance of the American Sesame Street was that they got funk players to come in and do stuff like that, and they had Stevie Wonder.
Boy, Stevie, you know, you really play good. Do you think you could teach me something? Hmm? Please,
I got something just for you, Grover.
Oh, yeah? Oh, good.
Just
good.
For you. Just
oh, go
for
ahead,
you.
Go ahead.
Goes like this. Sada bada 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 ba.
Oh boy! Here, redo it now. I'm going to do it. Okay, here we go. Bada bada da do ba ska do ba ba.
Now we gotta try. It was almost right.
Almost, not close, huh?
Gotta put a little more feeling into it.
Little more feeling.
Little more feeling.
Snap my fingers, help.
But I think that's what inspired Clive Vandenberg when he did Today's Special. You know, he had Oscar Peterson come in, and, you know, there's this amazing episode where Oscar Peterson's hanging out with the Today's Special crew, and they're doing cover versions of the theme song with him, you know, the Canadian Brass, and very big believers in using music as well to get in those shows. It sounds very trite now, but I think, too, a lot of the multiculturalism that was happening in Toronto was, of course, manifesting itself in these shows. And it wasn't that they were sitting around saying, well, we need to do it like this. It just, that's what people that worked at TV Ontario looked like. And I know, I mean, again, it's not recorded, but there were issues with things like Polka Dot Door when they would have two hosts of color at the same time in the 80s when that was being watched across the border. Because if you're in Detroit, if you're in Buffalo, you can pick up the signal. And, you know, Sesame Street obviously had a huge African-American cast, but there was never an episode where it was just the African-American hosts. But that was happening on Polka Dot Door. And then a program like Razzle Dazzle, which... Razzle Dazzle was like a news magazine program that was on every day.
And here's Hal and Michelle.
Say, kids, when you're writing with your pen and ink, does this often happen to you?
Do you get a great big ink smudge right on your sleeve? Does that leaky pen ruin your best shirt?
A huge, huge sensation. And I think it was really interesting because they were doing user-generated content. Like, right off the bat, that was baked into the idea of the show, is that it was for kids by kids. So their kids are sending in jokes, kids are sending in skits, kids are sending in all their ideas. They're doing them, but they also had their studio audience. They would bus in kids from Toronto schools. So you go to a taping of Razzle Dazzle.
But, show?
Yeah.
Okay.
Nina Keough, who, of course, the great puppeteer, her father created the puppet Howard the Turtle, who was kind of the mascot of Razzle Dazzle.
Hey, guess what? I've got 10,000 bones in my body. Know why? I had sardines for lunch.
And so she remembers as a child being in the studio audience and looking around and going, wow, like it's a reflection of the city, right? And again, these were things that when the camera would pan across the audience, you're seeing a whole bunch of different Toronto people of different cultures. In the American program, certainly in the border towns, there just wasn't anything like that. So these were things that at the time would have been quite probably alarming to some people in America.
These albums are all yours as well. I mean, I guess they released LPs for everything at one point. Concert of Concerts, starring the Friendly Giant, Mr. Dress-Up, Sharon Lowe's and Blem, One Elephant and Deux Elephants, Mr. Dress-Up and Friends. Wow. Were these things you collected at the time, or are these things you got later in life?
Yeah, I mean, I'm full disclosure, I'm a garage sale thrifter. I spend a lot of time going to estate sales, and I've always been interested in records. But what I like about this is, you know, nowadays when you're making a kid's television program, the very first thing they talk about is merchandise. You know, it's like the show comes out of the merchandise. Whereas back then, nobody even thought about it. It was like an afterthought. And so the records were kind of the only thing. If you were really into Mr. Dress-Up and you wanted to have some part of it in your house, that was about the best. You know, there was no Casey and Finnegan plush dolls, you know, at Zeller's.
What kind of music is on these?
It's mostly music from the episodes. So, you know, they'd do songs about Canada, or, you know, songs about certain things. But, I mean, this stuff was huge. Huge Sam the Record Man. I have a picture somewhere that we wanted to put in where, you know, that Mr. Dress-Up record was like the number one record that week. It beat the Rolling Stones or something, but yeah, it was kind of wild.
How much is it reasonable to expect people outside of Ontario to know about TV, the shows TVO created, or know about TVO? Or these memories belong to people from Ontario?
I think obviously the channel is very ingrained in people that are from Ontario, but a lot of those programs were very, very successful around the world. I mean, I talk a lot about Today's Special being the number one program on Nickelodeon for about 8 years, which led to people thinking it was an American program. Polka Dot Dora was, you know, as we said, was sold around the world. And a lot of these things ended up on PBS in America. So you have a lot of Americans that woke up early on Sunday morning and read all about it, you know, in Texas somewhere, and probably thought, what is this? You know, it would have just been the strangest thing ever.
Yeah, I mean, TVO was a public broadcaster with a much more explicit educational mandate. Bill Davis's idea about this is what the future of education will be. It will be through the television. It will be through screens. They will eventually come to replace teachers. But it ended up creating, I guess, that's a similar sort of environment to what you described at the CBC in the early 50s of experimentation, of like, oh, shit, we have this time to fill and we have resources. What is the most fun and interesting and edifying thing we can do for children? And so I guess Polka Dot Dora is the first big success out of that?
Yeah, I mean, Polka Dot Dora was very interesting background because there was a program on BBC in the UK called Play School. And they really liked it, and they wanted to show
it on... Yeah, it's a remake, too. That's how I always forget that. Yeah,
so they wanted, but instead of just buying Play School, they said, why don't we sort of buy a version, which now is a huge part of the television industry. I mean, you know, it's like The Amazing Race Canada and, you know, MasterChef Canada. But this was a new idea to take another country's program and retool it a little bit. So they took the toys, they took the concept of it, but they added Pokeroo. That was the sort of Canadian bent. And, yeah, I mean, it was another one of those programs. If you look at it now, it's very slow, very methodical. But it was about creating a safe space that children could basically use their imaginations. So it was whether they were telling a story or playing in the sandbox. it was about, you know, feeling your emotions and being calm. And I found even when I was older, you know, at university, it was nice to wake up after a night out and watch Polka Dot Door. It was very calming.
Fun fact, my first concert was Sharon, Lois, and Bram.
Oh, amazing, yeah.
And I guess one of the other themes, as you mentioned, but certainly running throughout the exhibit, is how Toronto shows in their representations of diversity were ahead of children's shows, other shows generally, and other stuff in the States. And you pointed at Polka Dot Door as being an example of that, that maybe the Elephant Show wasn't, but like...
Well, no, yeah. Amazingly, Elephant Show, I mean, the thing I think that was very progressive about it, Elephant Show is they did a lot with children with disabilities. So you'd see full episodes of that, and that was pretty groundbreaking then. I mean, the 80s, really, there was programs like, obviously, Degrassi, but Dear Aunt Agnes, I don't know if you remember that.
Dear Aunt Agnes, remember, you said you'd help me out if you could. Well, my job is taking me far away. To move the children just wouldn't be good. If you will say, you will come and say, you'd be the best and a girl ever had.
That was an attempt to make a program for kids who were not quite teenagers, but they were not kids anymore. Because there was nothing, for that demo back then. We call those, I guess, tweens now. But Dear Aunt Agnes was about a couple of kids whose parents were getting divorced. And so they wanted to show the huge number of kids in Ontario whose parents were getting divorced that you could live through it and that there was, you know, other ways that you could get help.
It was a weird experience being a kid where most of the culture was American, but there was this other space that was Canadian, but it was also often British. And so I'd watch, like, Dr. Snuggles on TVO yeah. And, like, you know, My Name is Simon.
Dr. I'm
fan. Yeah, but you never knew if it was British or Canadian. The only way I knew that Polka Dot Door was Canadian is because my mom was an actress at the time. And she would tell me, she'd be like, oh, I was in a Shakespeare with that guy on Polka Dot Door. Like, oh, that one's gay. Or, oh, yeah, we were in a Ponderosa ad together. And otherwise, because it was kind of like, where do these things exist? They exist in kids' TV land, so yeah. Who knows if they're British or Canadian or what.
Yeah, I mean, just before I get to that, the idea that these hosts on Polka Dot Door, I mean, they were working actors. And there was a host, Sherry Miller, a famous actress from Toronto, and she was the host of Polka Dot Door for years and years and years, but she was also doing commercials at the same time for Spumante Bambino, which is like a cheap plonk champagne. And I just think that's hilarious that you'd see the same girl in a kid show, you know, doing alcohol ads. But no, to your point, Jesse, I think TVO was a wonderful collection of homegrown stuff, but they would go out and buy these absolutely crazy programs from around the world, animation and, you know, things like Barba Papa. And sometimes if there wasn't a dub in English, they would actually do the English dub. And so there's certain versions of those European animated shows that are totally lost to time because it was like, you know, the tapes are gone and there's different versions of those shows but with different dubs on them.
Who dubbed The Green Forest, which scared the living shit out of me?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot. You can go down a rabbit hole on the web about Green Forest fans that have tracked down the actors and everything. But that was a Japanese animation.
Cherry, this is the thing that got you most excited.
A couple of years ago, I was talking to my cousin, and we're kind of the same age, and she was like, do you remember that show about the mice? And we couldn't remember. And it took us, like, months and months and months, and finally she stumbled on, like, a Google search, and she was like, it was Book Mice. And so when I saw this, I was like, it's Book Mice. And I think it's just so funny, because, like, we had zero memory of what it was called.
Book Mice! Book Mice! They live inside the library. Book Mice! Behind the wall where no one can see. Look twice.
I don't remember anything else about the show, but these are probably the cutest puppets here. They're just three mice, and like a very cute cat puppet. Like, what is it? Other than the fact that it was more, I think it was Nina Kale.
Yeah.
Like, what was? Was there just? Is there anything special about Book Place?
I mean, there is. It was originally called the Magic Library when it started, and then it turned into Book Mice. But one of the things, I guess, for a certain people of a certain age really remember it because it was on when cable channels, I don't know if you remember, sort of in the mid-90s, we had this explosion of new channels, which was like the most exciting thing ever because we went from having 24 channels to 40 channels. And then Discovery was one of those channels. And they had a huge kids programming block, and they used to run Book Mice like 8 hours a day. So you would see a lot of Book Mice. Even if you were just channel surfing, you'd land on it. But Book Mice was really one of the first shows, certainly one of the biggest shows at TVO that incorporated a lot of indigenous writing into the storylines. And again, not a huge deal was made about it at the time. It's like impossible to find episodes of it. I think I have two. I don't even know if it still exists at TVO. But it certainly was to me, it's gotten the most recognition in the exhibit from people that had, like you, forgotten that it even what it was called. So there was clearly something to that.
What do you remember about it?
I just remember it was a cool show with like these funny mice and they read books. I just remember being on all the time, like you mentioned, but I had no memory of what it was called.
Is TVO worse than other, like others are keeping records? Like the CBC seemed like they had
the CBC do a phenomenal job.
Yeah,
and they always have. The problem with TVO, every time there's a change in provincial government, because it answers to the Minister of Education, the priorities change. So I know, for example, when Bob Ray, what year would that have been? 90.
Well, he was, 93, he's elected 90.
Okay, so 90.
Yeah.
That was when the cutbacks started, and some of the first things they did was to start getting rid of the tapes. And back then it was on a format called 3/4 inch. That was sort of the industry standard. And those tapes, I mean, they're a pain in the ass, even if you can find them now to transfer them. But back then they just said, well, we're never going to repeat these. And, you know, they've sold them on to some of the other countries, but then they had their copies of it. So they didn't need to retain some of the masters. So they started getting rid of it, or they reused the tapes. They just taped over them. And heartbreaking. But there is an institution that still exists who was given a bunch of TVO stuff, and they decided to throw it away because they said, well, why do we need more than 5 tapes of Polka Dot Door? I mean, you know, it's this attitude that it's all kind of samey and that it's not really culturally relevant that we keep bumping up against.
Yeah. And so then you get into the 1990s, and then YTV is, I think, it's the only real private broadcaster that's majorly spotlighted in here. YTV was a national channel, right? Yeah. How would you describe its contribution to all of this?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about how TV Ontario was really the driving force behind trying to get a dedicated kids network off the ground. It didn't work out. You get to the mid-80s, we have this explosion of pay TV, you know, Much Music and TSN, and suddenly it becomes a very viable commercial business, right, to have a kids channel. And then you just had, again, a very interesting group of people come together, and they were kind of winging it. You know, they wanted to run that television station like it was a radio station. And they had, you know, the PJs, who were their version of the VJs at Much
Program
Music.
Program jockeys, right?
The program jockeys. And they were there because YTV showed less commercials because they wanted to be parent-friendly. But that meant they had all this time because, an episode of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is 22 minutes and they're only showing 3 minutes of commercials. So then people like PJ Phil would literally have to just make stuff up every 25 minutes. And, these guys were great because they, you know, he'd pick up his guitar or he'd just tell you a story about something that happened to him. And again, it was that talking to a friend. Very much reminded me of that Fred Rainsbury ethos. And again, I don't know these guys. It's not like they were sitting around planning any. It's just the way that they were making television. And for young people at the time, it was pretty amazing. It was like having a cool older brother, you know, to come home to after school. And I like when YTV started, the late, great John Candy kicked it off with the opening night special. And that was because John Candy got his first television break on a TVO show called Cucumber, which was directed by Clive Vandenberg.
Who in the world are we going to get to help us? What's that?
Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Is it the...
It's a weatherman.
Oh, boy, am I glad to see you. Hey, listen, do you know anything about the weather?
Well, my name isn't Tomato Man, it's Weatherman. Of course I know about weather.
Oh, good. Look, maybe you can help my friend over there.
And a lot of those Second City people, like Catherine O'Hara and Eugene Levy, they all did time at TVO because back then the only grown-up show that was filming in Toronto was King of Kensington. And, you know, they're jobbing actors, so they did Second City at night and they did the kid shows in the day. It's not in this exhibit because it wasn't made in Toronto, but there was a show in Ottawa called You Can't Do That on Television, which Nickelodeon basically stole their whole brand from that show. Like, the slime was obviously a big part of that program. And again, to this day, everyone thinks it's a U.S. thing, but it was made in Ottawa.
I think that's the show that introduced me to the term Pinko Commie.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And, of course, Alanis Morissette got her start.
Yeah, there was some dad character who was like a drunk guy in like a white, you know, we don't call him that anymore, but that kind of T-shirt. And he was like some kind of reactionary anti-communist, if I remember.
Yeah, he was meant to be a sort of a pastiche of Archie Bunker. Because even this is the other funny thing. You look at programs, they assume kids know who that All in the Family and things like, you know, that you would, there's no cultural relationship to those things for young people now, but that's what I think he was meant to be.
And so over here you have like 10 televisions playing. Are these all Degrassi? Degrassi clips? I mean, I don't know how.
Yeah, so it's a mixture of Kids of Degrassi Street, which was the first series from 1979, and then Junior High, which was 86 to 92. And yeah, I mean, I think I said it earlier, it was, to me, the most important contribution culturally in television that we gave the world, I think it was, again, because it came out of this idea of documentary, not hiring actors, not really writing it like a drama, more exploring what kids were going through. And, you know, the scale of the issues just kept going up. So in Kids of Degrassi Street, a whole episode might be centered around a sleepover where somebody says something mean about somebody else. And then you get to Junior High and it's about, you know, pregnancy. And then you get flash forward to the Drake era and, you know, people are blowing up schools. It's a little bit more Hollywood now. And the actors, they all sort of look a certain way and they all talk the same. But this era is really Martian television because it's just capturing stuff that nobody was doing. And I do believe that's why it's insanely popular even still in places like Australia and the UK.
One of the things I've been thinking about is how we have all these shared culture memories of Canadian children's television shows, but very few of scripted shows made for adults. I mean, the stuff that there is kind of maybe, like King of Kensington, I think is still on, but no one would watch it. Some people have an attachment to the Beachcombers. It looks terrible. Whereas you look at this and like, I could understand what the appeal would still be for a person of the correct age. Like, so we were better. Like, it's not just my imagination. Like, there is a shared cultural consciousness around children's television in Canada that it doesn't really exist in the same way for adult television.
I mean, I think so. Certainly, there was a lot of interesting stuff happening in adult television in the early days of CBC, and some of the plays they used to do, and certainly when Moses was at CBC, was doing wild stuff long before he was at City TV. But again, it's not really, not a lot has been preserved, not a lot is written about it. But yeah, you're talking about more sort of the junky scripted series, yeah, like Cats and Dog and things like that.
There's always like a lot of really interesting nonfiction experimental types of documentary shows. Like, there's definitely a history of that, but in terms of, I guess, yeah, scripted series, whether comedies or dramas, it feels like a much more sparse record.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I mean, I said it earlier, I think comedy, children's, and news are the things that we've always done the best. And I do think it has been recognized around the world by other sort of students and professors of television that was happening. But why is it still, there's such pushback to do anything with it? You know, in America, they have the Library of Congress, which provides millions of dollars to preserve episodes of the most obscure, you know, Captain Kangaroo and things like that. But yet in Canada, there's the archives in Ottawa, you know, it's two people in a sled, you know, and they have no money and they have no time. And it's heartbreaking because eventually this stuff will all disappear. I mean, it really will.
Another question, so you end this exhibit in the mid-90s with YTV, and it's called Mystery of Degrassi. Why did you decide to end in the mid-90s?
it's the number one question for visitors to the exhibit. And the reason was that by the time we got to the mid-90s, there's a bunch of change in the air. You have the internet is already starting to take a pretty big hold. You have a lot of co-productions starting to crop up. So whereas before, these programs were 100%, you could call them Toronto programs. Now we were seeing co-productions with HBO, co-productions with the BBC. And so there's a lot of globalization going on, and they start to lose some of that sort of what we say is the authentic Toronto vision. But the main thing was then you had all the independent channels getting corporatized. So YTV was bought by Corus a couple years later, and everything kind of starts to get a bit blander. It is a bit safer. And things like the Concerned Children's Advertiser, I don't know if you remember them, they start producing a lot of public service announcements and stuff that they used to sort of handle, let's say, in a program like Degrassi or in Dear Ann Agnes, migrates from narrative television shows into PSAs. And again, they did a wonderful job, but it was less of an issue in the mid-90s for them to do it on TV on those programs.
Was that like the House Hippo?
Yes, House Hippo. Don't put it in your mouth. Not Astron. That was a different one. That's another classic. But no, the 94, January 1, 94 was when Warren Grogg, who's that green grotesque puppet behind you, him and his friend Filth, and there's the footage playing, they literally hijacked the YTV satellite and they just showed the programs they wanted to watch all day. So they showed like 2 hours of Adam West Batman and just random movies. And it was, you know, I was in university at the time, but I was really fascinated with this idea that, you know, it was kind of a punk thing to do. Meanwhile, PJ Phil and the Good Grogs were outside the building. That's now the Zoomer building, by the way, but they were trying to get in and regain control of the satellite. And then the next day, the Grogs disappeared and they were never mentioned again. And basically it was because the puppeteers were fired because they didn't sign a contract literally giving the ownership of the Grogs to YTV. Wow.
And that's when they were replaced by Snit, the talking television monster?
Snit came a couple of months later, okay. But yeah, that's right. That's right. So yeah, it seemed, and again, the symmetry or the bookends of Chichimus and Warren Chester Grogg, it seemed like a nice place to end it.
Beyond the nostalgia bomb, what do you hope people come away from this exhibit thinking?
I hope they come away with a sense of pride that we were on the vanguard for a lot of this stuff and that there were these things that were maybe they weren't aware of before. Even if they take away one factoid, you know, that they can break out at a dinner party and talk about why these things are important. But I think more than that, we just wanted to do a show that made people happy. The one thing that unites us is this idea that we all grew up watching these shows together. We had that shared experience, and it brings us joy. So,
thank you. Is there anything else?
I wanted to ask, so you mentioned for a lot of the shows, like there's no tapes available or not a lot of tapes. What's one show that you wish there were more tapes for?
Oh, boy. Uncle Bobby was on from 1967 to 1980, and CTV doesn't even have one episode of it in their archive. Like, it's entirely gone.
What was that?
There was a program TVO made that was shot at the ROM in the 70s called Secret of the Samurai that has all kinds of, it sounds incredible, again, with no budget, about a ghost of a samurai, you know, terrorizing children at the ROM.
I remember that one. Okay. I swear I've seen that one.
Yeah, I mean, it was shown in classrooms, but it's totally gone. Like, there's not a frame of it anywhere, unfortunately. I mean, there's a lot, but I would say those are probably the top two. So,
could I have, like, a minute with the puppets in there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually?
Yeah, I'll meet you just
okay. I don't know what you want to do with the puppets.
Resolve some issues.
Okay.
Face some fears.
That is your Canada Land. We are still on Twitter at Canada Land, and our website is canadaland.com. I'm Jonathan Goldsby, and you can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com, though I will be off on vacation by the time this airs, so I don't know, bother jesse@canadaland.com. Much gratitude to Ed Conroy for taking the time to walk me, Jesse Brown, and Shuri Suturin through the exhibit, and to him and the Museum of Toronto for putting it together. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson, our audio editor and technical producer is Tristan Capicchioni, our managing editor is Annette Ajofo, and our new editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by Sokolt. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, whom you can visit online at cfuv.ca.
Alors,
tu es un ananas.
Oui, c'est vrai. Je suis un ananas.
Elle est française.